So I gave the first half of this paper at UNSW last month, and it's, I think, coherent. The second half of the paper, which I'm going to give today, is not so coherent. So I expect there to be it to tangle up minds a little bit more, because my own mind is a little bit tangled at the moment. But I was able to get it finished to be able to send off to the reviewers to get the reports. So I think this is a good opportunity to kind of air in a kind of mode of confidence things and concepts and ideas that I'm actually not at all confident in as they currently stand. So it's the chapter brief, because it's an introduction to world literature, is to talk about the problem of scale when the concept of world literature arises. And this problem of scale is one that looks very different according to the methodological orientation of the world literature researcher. And what the chapter does, more or less, is it sketches out a narrative from a period when methodologies relating or pertaining to world literature were very much in a humanist speculative mode, a narrative from that, and a transition into a new development in world literary studies, which is about 15 years old, where the problem of scale becomes an empirical problem, because where in a globalized world, therefore, working out how literature is totalized in this world becomes a kind of problem of data and of numbers. But I'm going to get into this. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read out the first three introductory paragraphs of the chapter, and then I'm going to PowerPoint my way through the first half of the paper, and then read out the part of the paper that I really want to present to you, which is the second half, and particularly that part of the paper where I start to talk about literature, which is a great relief when I get there. Do we have faith in world literature? Do we believe that such a thing exists? Can we expect to make world literature an object of consciousness? Given the scale of our object, for whatever it is, world literature presumably is big, questions concerning its actuality typically have been posed, at least in recent times, in relation to knowledge, and especially as it concerns the means of cognizing world literature. How can we know world literature has been the key question. The question of faith is different to that of knowledge, even if both take us in the same direction. If we have faith in the existence of world literature, we can pursue an inquiry into its nature and analyze its constituent elements with the assurance that our efforts will bear fruit. Faith precedes knowledge. It could even be said to ground knowledge insofar as it motivates the acts that imbue the object with a specific content. I have faith in the sturdiness of my chair or that my investment will yield returns, but I will not know this until it bears my weight or I receive the dividends into my account. I mean, that's a very kind of pat way of thinking about faith, which isn't my intention. Without such faith, what use inquiring into the purpose and parameter of world literature? Knowledge needs faith, but not necessarily the reverse. Many people have faith in an absolute: God, human rights, the possibility of communist society, and yet are reconciled to the fact that they may well never be able to prove its existence. In such situations, we speak of a leap of faith. This leap may not be subjected to empirical verification, but believers nevertheless will refer to concrete experiences of their faith. I have faith in human rights because I have seen people treat each other with compassion where it goes against their material interest. I have faith in God because I have seen his self-proclaimed son cure the blind. Is research into world literature similarly impelled by world literature experiences? Presumably, and I ask that seriously, presumably something of this order is what happened when Wolfgang Johann von Goethe read Jean-Pierre Abel Remusat's preface to and translation of the Chinese novel Yu Qiao Li and began seriously to entertain the notion of Weltliteratur. He experienced a profound sense of the connectedness of literary activity across diverse human cultures and temporalities. Goethe barely had any substantive knowledge of literary practice beyond Western Europe, but this did not stop him from intuiting a totality whose parameter encompassed literary cultures across the earth. A world is a particular totality as it is known and constituted by those who dwell in it. When we speak of Shakespeare's world, we do not mean the entire earth, circa 1600. We mean that world to which his plays attest and which they in turn constitute. This involved the political conflicts of the British Isles, in which he was embedded, for example, Macbeth, but also a cultural memory that ranged back hundreds of years to the Mediterranean, Antony and Cleopatra, and a broadening geographical sensibility formed by the early extra-European colonial expansion, as we see in The Tempest. The motto of the Globe Theatre, where his plays were performed, Totus Mundus Agit Historionum, the whole world is a playhouse, announces the ambition to encompass the globe, but it could not have staged plots drawn from the dreaming of Australia's indigenous peoples, nor political intrigues within the Luba Empire in Central Africa. These were not part of Shakespeare's world, even though they were on the earth in his time. On the other hand, the notion of world literature is not relative. It does not mean a particular world, but refers to the literary totality as it is conceived by the proposer of world literature, extending beyond her particular literary experiences to that totality of which she believes them to be a component. If she wishes to explore the bounds of this totality, she must choose an orientation and point of departure, one that presupposes a certain conception of the literary as well as an intuition about its extensionality. In other words, to embark on a study of world literature necessitates an act of faith that connects world to literature. And this fundamentally conditions how we conceive of the scale of world literature. In this chapter, I will explore the recurrent question of scale by concentrating on this precondition of faith, addressing along the way the manner in which we conceptualize the systems that synthesize world literature into a totality. To think the scale of world literature is not to ask a question about the empirical reality in which literary cultures exist. We do not seek to know whether there are organisms in other solar systems who write tragedies, but to focus on the way in which literature is totalized. So that's the opening. And then I just want to quickly go through the first section of the chapter proper, which is called The Human Scale. So here I just talk about the humanist conception of world literature that followed from its conceptual birth at around the time of Goethe. And the basic argument, or I guess claim I'm making in this first section, is that the humanist conception of world literature proceeded from a leap of faith in the universality of literature as such. And this informed the way methodologies of interpretation were formed. And this was very much world literature as a kind of secular humanist theology where you were, because you presumed a certain connection between literary cultures that was fundamental, you could therefore explore this totality by starting with the particular, and the particular would lead you out to the universal. So, frankly, speculative methods were not just admissible, but they were necessary for the practice of world literature interpretation. So three examples are that of the Russian philologist and literary theorist, kind of grandfather of Russian formalism, Alexander Veselovsky, whose historical poetics posits to begin with deep morphological continuities in literary genres so that you can think about how particular literary forms in certain historical conditions will appear and then reappear when those similar conditions happen or occur at a later stage. Eric Auerbach, a notion that hasn't been taken very far, but a friend of mine from when I lived in England has written an entire monograph around this idea of the Ansatzpunkt. And this is where you work. He suggests that what you do is you work from a particular trope or notion or theme in one work which you believe to have a radiating power, which will lead you, in a sense, into the greater totalization of literature. And then, probably most recently, the greatest exponent of this humanist tradition of world literary studies is Edward Said, whose notion of contrapuntal reading I actually wrote my master's on. So thank Chris for pointing out the musicological connection. And this is basically an analogy for intrinsic relationships between core and periphery literary interactions. I don't go into it in this paper, but I think there's actually a very strong lineage of Vico in these reflections. It's actually if humans make literature, then we can understand literature as something fundamental to how humans negotiate their world. So that's, you know, sort of new science. The thing I then go on to in this section is talk about the emergence of world literature, both as something that happened as European colonial expansion started to accelerate and there was a greater integration of intellectual discourse between nations, particularly in Europe. That's one side of the coin of the world literature concept. Another side of the coin of its emergence was the manifestation of a new concept of the literary as such. It's a really interesting thing that a man called Stefan Hörsel-Jülich points out is that when Goethe's talking about world literature, he's talking, when he says literature, he means more something like letters, intellectual discourse in general, rather than literature, that is, a history of works of aesthetic value. And it was actually the notion of literature as works, the history of works of aesthetic value, that world literature, that will become fundamentally connected to the notion of world literature. And so as this sort of hypostatized and congealed into institutional practice, this became this kind of world literature as, you know, the great canon of all human masterpieces. Famously, the Norton Anthology of 1956, World Masterpieces of the Western Canon, and afterward that became just the sort of world literature anthology. But a really funny and I think more symptomatic volume is this one by Martin Seymour Smith, The Guide to Modern World Literature, where he pretends as though he's read 7,500 novels in the 20th, or novels and poems and plays in the 20th century, and then kind of, it kind of gives you a kind of cook's tour of what's good and what's bad. So, for example, when he comes to the section on Arabic poetry, he says, Arabic poetry has changed in form over the past 100 years. Its content has remained consistently dull. And there's a lot of this, like pretty much every page has these very, whoa, that's unstable, has these very kind of funny claims. But the point being that world literature shrinks when you have this idea of the absolute value of certain masterpieces, and you can more or less skim read most of world literature because you have this idea that, you know, there's the greats. But I say that the humanist, the sort of critical humanist tradition is very different to that sort of hypostatized canonization tradition, and that one, it's more like evangelical fervor as against a very skeptical and cautious approach that you get in that the critical humanist tradition, where it's not so much the case that world literature exists, but this sense that something is emerging, a greater totality is emerging, and it's something that we need to explore on the basis of its literary essence, as it were. So it's more a teleological and ideal concept in that tradition. So then 15 years ago, this new world literary studies emerged, particularly as motivated by three important works, one by Pascal Casanova, one by Franco Moretti, and another by David Damrosch, which are constantly referenced with good reason. They have constituted a new way and a new arena for literary research in a way, none of which is satisfying, but I think has posed new questions that were not being asked. But this whole new world literary studies phenomenon took a decisively empirical turn away from that ideal notion of world literature as teleological and emergent. And now it is, we are in the era of globalization, therefore we are in the era of world literature. So let's work out how all this literature connects and intersects and what it is, what it kind of adds up to as a total. Now, as you happen when you have this kind of deductive structure for research, you get a lot of syllogisms, and I think something I talk about briefly is this sort of syllogistic fallacy that, so if all human communities produce literature, one assumption, and all human communities across the earth have been assimilated into a single global economic and political system, a world system, then all literature is world literature. Now, this is the fallacy of four terms, and I've got a quote from Moretti on the handout, sort of the fourth one down, where he said, I will borrow this initial hypothesis from the World System School of Economic History, for which international capitalism system, one with a core periphery that are bound together with a relationship of growing equal. One and unequal, one literature, Weltliteratur, singular as in Goethe and Marx, or perhaps better, one world literary system of interrelated literatures, but a system which is different from what Goethe and Marx had hoped for. So the slippage is there, that Goethe and Marx had hoped for something, they had an ideal notion of world literature, but we've got something else. And we now need to study that other thing, which must be literature, in a sense, in the era of global modern capitalism. So there's a slippage where world, in one sense, as this kind of ideal concept, slips into world as an empirical problem. And so Moretti famously saw the future of world literary studies as one that must pursue a distant reading, not actually read text and speculate on their meaning. So much as compile and synthesize large swathes of data in order to be able to work out what totality actually existing literary practice constitutes. Now, my problem is not that this is a bad idea or a stupid thing to do. It's simply that why would you call that world literature? Why would you retain the semantic halo of this ideal concept and use it to explore, as it were, literature in the age of globalization? There's no good reason why you couldn't just call this literature and globalization studies. The argument I make at the end of this section, or the direction it goes, is to say, well, if you actually read these studies that proceed from an empirical basis, what they end up doing, Moretti included, is they end up gravitating to the kind of telling moment in a literary text. They end up doing interpretation against their own methodological settings, in this sort of sense that that ideal concept of world literature is still operative, but in a kind of suppressed mode. And without a doubt, particularly those left critics in the field, which is most liberal and Marxist, end up constituting world literature as that which critiques globalization. So often it's the novel of globalization, multi-strand plotting, that receives attention. And I think this is somewhat problematic for reasons I will now talk about, because we're up to the bit where I give my paper proper, or the bit that I want to read out. Okay. World literature as a negative faith, this section is called. The empirical turn in the new world literary studies entailed a dialectical reversal vis-a-vis faith. Where faith in literature had been the basis for investigating its particular modes of totalization across human communities, now a certainty regarding the world's systematic unity circumscribed investigation into the literary. Left behind was a constitutive paradox that lay at the heart of the critical humanist teleological vision. In short, it was apparent to them that the circumstances that augured world literature's emergence also threatened the existence of the literary as such. Auerbach wrote, and this is on the handout, "Man will have to accustom himself to the existence in a standardized world, to a single literary culture, with only a few literary languages, and perhaps even a single literary language. And herewith, the notion of Weltliteratur would be at once realized and destroyed." The profound implications of this oft-quoted comment have bubbled beneath the surface of the new world literary studies, but only rarely have they consciously been deliberated on. If world literature's passage from ideal to actuality is brought about by the welding of capital, it is inaugurated by the same forces that erode literature's substance, at least according to Auerbach. The reason that the prophesied world literature has not arrived in the hoped-for form is that literary practice opposes itself to the logic that compels its globalization, the supremacy of exchange over use value, consumerism over human need. This is not to suggest that by dint of being exchanged as a commodity and traded globally, literary value is eliminated at a stroke. Rather, that as literary works are assimilated into market circuits and exchangeability become the raison d'etre for their existence, literary practice responds by insisting on its intrinsically expressive purpose. This needs to be understood dialectically. We noted earlier that world literature's conceptual birth was coeval with an aesthetically oriented conception of literature. This conceptual evolution formed part of a broader diremption, that's a Hegelian term, which I'm very fond of value at the time into use and exchange as it was placed under strain by the ascendancy of capitalist modes of production. The critical theorists Max Horkheimer and Theodor Adorno would later diagnose this as part of a dialectic of enlightenment, which might be paraphrased as the state of reason under capitalism. They posit a deep correlation between the ways in which capitalism assigned abstract value ratios to non-identical objects in order profitably to trade them, and a positivistic reason that seeks to classify non-identical things in order to make instrumental use of them. Art thus fights against both exchange value and instrumental reason by asserting its autonomy from commerce and instrumental use. If this appraisal is correct, and I'm obviously suggesting it is, then world literature has been a self-cannibalizing concept from the beginning. On the one side, the capitalist world system consumes the literary. On the other, the literary tries to protect its substance and projects itself towards an alternative social reality in which it could thrive. The New World Literary Studies has made the former aspect the arena for its investigation. This is the way in which the capitalist world system consumes the literary. This goes some way to explaining why there has been such a strong tendency to recuperate the literary as that which critiques globalization, and why it is so often novels which thematize global social crisis and or reflect on their own global circulation that receive the bulk of attention from the New World Literary Studies. This has left unanswered the question of what happens at the other pole, the ways in which literature has sought to shield its substance from globalization, constructing its own forms and spheres of practice as it does so. Here we might find a neo-humanist world literature, for which world literature serves as a negative article of faith rather than as a positive empirical concept. World literature as that literature which negates literature's globalization. I'm just going to cut out a section where I talk about some other scholars who have gone in this direction. But they more or less go in a deconstructive direction. They talk about literature's ontology as difference and so forth. A different point of departure presents itself in looking to the historical dialectic of literary materials and communities as they are assimilated into and resist their totalization by capitalist relations of production. The comments of M. A. Césaire and Kamau Brathwaite that serve as epigraph to this essay can help to orient us in this respect. Césaire's comment, so now I'm talking about the top on the handout, Césaire's comment comes in a letter to Maurice Thoré in which he critiques the emaciated universalism of European communism. This brings him to envision an ideal form of universalism that consists of, quote, the deepening and coexistence of all particulars. This is not the sum total of particulars in their existing state, but a concentration of their particularity and the production of conditions in which these could coexist. For Brathwaite, consumed, this is in the 1970s, with the task of forging a Caribbean literary Creole culture in the wake of its suppression under colonial rule, this necessitates deflecting the cosmopolitan vision that would render Caribbean creolization as a generic model for thinking about transcultural exchange in general. The note of urgency is telling. A Creole culture must find its own ground, quote, before it is too late. Before, as Auerbach has it, world literature is realized and destroyed as a homogeneous unity. World for Brathwaite is normative. It is a world that will value Creole culture's particularity and which does not wish to see everywhere a reflection of itself. So both Brathwaite and Césaire in these comments clearly see the dangers of parochialism, and that is not their objective. What they are calling for is a solidarity of localisms in the name of an alternative universalism. A solidarity, it must be stressed, that is not realized necessarily through direct collaboration, but as an implicit alignment of purpose. And this is what I'm going to be focusing on, an implicit alignment of purpose, because you can also say, oh, you know, here are these avant-garde and poets in different places that have collaborations, so, you know, it's all transnational and blah, 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 blah. That's not my point whatsoever. But not to say that that's not a relevant consideration. I'm just trying to steer a different path here. So this solidarity of localisms. If we were to adjust our sight and focus attention on such implicit solidarities, what we would find in direct contradiction to those theorists who wish to see only global connectedness and transnational exchange is world literature as a patchwork of dogged non-synchronicity in which authors and readers stubbornly dedicate themselves to literary forms and local fields in spite of their apparent structural redundancy. A world literature comprised of literary communities impelled by the ideal of civic sovereignty, a world literature for which a specific readership or audience is a necessary condition of production, a world literature ambivalent about questions of distribution and metropolitan reception. Of course, the local is just as vexed a proposition as the global in conditions of accelerated capital accumulation, beset by all manner of contradictions and misrecognitions. These become all the more acute when the local serves merely as a conceptual placeholder for a hoped-for literary content to be supplied at a future date, or as the affirmation of cultural externalities in a liberal parade of identities. Let me be clear that I am not talking about localism for its own sake, nor a geographically constrained sense of the term, but highlighting the tendency for the particular to become the locus of the literary under conditions of globalization, what Alexander Beecroft suggestively calls the epicoric sphere of literary production and reception. There's a long footnote, which is interesting, but I obviously don't have time to talk about Beecroft. Very, very interesting book about literary ecologies. In asserting this, though, we come up against a conceptual contradiction, for if it is hoped to unite all such practices under the banner of the local or epicoral, following Beecroft, we might only end up subordinating the particular to the general by another means. Rather than fastening down on an a priori definition of the local, we can take inspiration from Paul Celan's notion of the meridian, as elaborated in his speech of the same name, which furnishes the final epigraph of this essay. This is the third on your... The meridian refers to the position of the sun when it reaches its highest point at noon. Geographically, it refers to that alignment of terrestrial locations where noon is experienced simultaneously, you know, the Greenwich Mean Time idea. Light in Celan's essay, though, is not sunlight, but the light that shines from the poem and which guides us when we explore its meaning. It is a utopian light, that's U-topian light. As glossed by Raymond Goyce, Celan's meridian provides an analogy for the way that poets and readers of poetry, quote, put things together. I think this is a great way of thinking about it. Put things together without such acts being, and this is Raymond Goyce, subsumed under a single concept. World literature, then, I think I've actually written this up so you can remember it, as an epicoric meridian put together by the critic who is oriented by the utopian light of literary work as they negate their globalization. Just as Auerbach suggests the critic must rely on her instinct when choosing an Ansatzpunkt, so must the meridian be constructed speculatively. Different meridians would not cumulatively yield a single meridian, but would present different ways of constituting world literature against globalization. So I'm a child of the 90s, ultimately, in anti-globalization movements. This is a cosmopolitan project, there can be no doubt, but one that terminates in the particular rather than the restless accumulation of difference. This points away from those materials that readily give themselves to circulation and towards one, a form of study that asserts the literary as a located and circumscribed activity whose enabling condition is precisely its locatedness. So rather than the multi-strand novel of globalization or born translated fictions, a concept that circulates in this field, our attention will be drawn to quite different materials, to poetry for one. I will turn finally to consider one possible epicoric meridian, that of literary primitivism, an aesthetic mode born in the so-called first era of globalization in the late 19th century, early 20th century, during which the epicoral qua the primitive became an article of faith. This is the bit I'm not happy about because it's packing way too much in, but you got to write it out sometime. So this section is called Denatured Brothers of My Longitude, which is a quote taken from the final thing on the handout. Dwelling is a persistent theme and objective in M.A. Césaire's 1948 collection Soleil Coupé. Published in Paris by an obscure modernist press, the poems in the volume were written over the course of the 1940s in Césaire's native Martinique, with several having appeared in the magazine Tropique. As with the English word dwelling, the French demeure is a noun form of a verb, demeurer, which prefers which refers to the act of staying, remaining, or persisting in a particular place. Une demeure is a structure constituted for and by the act of demeurant. It's been a while since I spoke French. In three separate poems, Césaire exploits the word's capacity to pivot between noun and verb by making it the head term in an anaphoric series of noun phrases whose adjectival component vacillates between action and object. By anaphoric incantation, Césaire's most characteristic technique, the speaker manically associates a list of components that make a dwelling, cumulatively building up a complex and contradictory image. The most sustained instance of this anaphoric manic association comes in Unmaking and Remaking the Sun. This is how the poem begins. I've got the French there as well, which is very important to refer to, but I'll read the English. Dwelling made of not knowing which way to turn. Dwelling made of saber glitter. Dwelling made of cut necks. Dwelling made of rainstorms of the deluge. Dwelling made of male harmonicas. Dwelling made of green water and female ocarinas. Dwelling made of the fallen angel feathers. Dwelling made of the wisps of little laughs. Dwelling made of alarm bells. Dwelling made of animal skins and eyelids. Dwelling made of mustard seeds. Dwelling made of fan fingers. Dwelling made of mace. Dwelling made of rain of little eyelashes. Dwelling made of an epidemic of drums. The opening line, which has the advantage of the reader's fresh mind, sets the scene, or rather unsettles it. This is not dwelling as repose, but dwelling as indecision and unstable stasis. The list that follows persistently subverts the syntax of representation. Objects are mismatched to verbs and modifiers. Verbal phrases are treated as nouns, and successive adjectival phrases contradict each other in such a way as to thwart the formation, even momentarily, of a single visual plane. As a consequence, the sense of an intention dissolves, and with it any notion that we should respond to the sequence as a series of deliberated utterances. If we were to remix the words, say, quote, dwelling made of a deluge of ocarinas, dwelling made of the wisps of drums, dwelling made of mace and little animal skins, it would barely alter the aesthetic effect as far as the relationship between syntax and image is concerned. This is not to suggest that the contents of these lines are utterly random or their aesthetic arrangement unimportant. Take the following pair as they appear in the French original. Demeure faite d'harmonica mâle, demeure faite d'eau verte et d'ocarina femelle. The opposition of male and female correlate to that of modern and ancient instruments. Ocarinas are small clay flutes, often formed in the shape of an animal. Binaries compounded by assonant and rhythmic parallelism. There are assonantal and rhythmic echoes throughout. So in the French, de grand de Senève, de droite d'éventail, touffe de petit rire, pluie de petit cil. Without these forming into regular pattern. Nor is the semantic content indifferent. Certain classes of object and actions recur, particularly bodily, meteorological, animalistic, sonic, Siberius, and fantastical, suggesting a consciousness compelled by certain desires. This is a dwelling full of natural forces, sensuality, and magic, intimating violence. Césaire's practice of aphoristic manic association is at least partly a result of his exposure to literary surrealism when he was a student in Paris in the 1930s. So I guess this is where world literature of a certain kind begins. He was in Paris. From the surrealist, he learned poetic processes that were intended to break congealed linguistic relationships and access otherwise repressed thoughts and ways of being. Two notions coined by the art surrealist André Breton succinctly capture the kind of aesthetic approach adopted and adapted by Césaire, the surreal image as exploding fixed and poetic procedure as objective chance. Césaire's processes of association are directed towards achieving oxymoronic, self-contradictory, or otherwise perverse effects which thwart the habits of identity thinking. These explosions are fixed into place, as it were, by the shell of a syntax that maintains its formal integrity. The aim is to reach, by means of apparent chance, hidden objective relations, both external, which is, I guess, the logic conditioning the production of material reality, and internal, the structures of subjective desire. While Breton's concepts helped us to help us to identify the poetic procedure, they do not determine meanings which only come with the substantive content. This poem challenges us to think this dwelling as projected by a consciousness unleashed from conscious control, of, or certainly of a certain kind. So after the part that I cite, and I don't cite this in the essay proper, the poem shifts to the first person with the I posing a question to a we, what will we look like on not defying the sea with a step more resounding than our frog-like hearts, and then addresses successively a jailer, a beautiful angel, and then a jailer again. In this section, the sense of conscious intent enters the poem, even if it is still hard to fathom what it is up to. It is clear enough, though, that these lines, one following the sequence, stage a confrontation. He tells the jailer to look at his clenched eyes, which in turn disgorge an image that includes a swarm of cockroaches. The speaker's anger next yields a bouquet of the angel's odour and a fistful of keys, keys that might, for example, open a dwelling. There is also a short prayer to a mother figure. The speaker then announces to the jailer that I am in my dwelling in your face, before coming to a final poem-ending statement of dwelling-making. Dwelling made of your impotence, of the power of my simple acts, of the freedom of my spermatozoa, dwelling black womb hung with a red curtain, soul altar I may bless while watching the world explode at the choice of my silence. Though hardly straightforward, these lines do reward close attention. The dwelling is made of your impotence, implicitly, though not necessarily, the jailer's, of the speaker's simple acts, and of his spermatozoa. Dwelling is then repeated, this time minus the anaphoric construction, i.e. dwelling made of, just dwelling, suspending it exactly between verb and noun. It is a dwelling, but it is also the spermatozoa dwelling in this sort of image of a sacralized black womb, an image tinged perhaps with silence, that sort of the curtain, the red curtain. From this place, the speaker watches the world explode at the option of my silence. This final iteration of dwelling-making gives itself more readily to intentional paraphrase, even if it still does not resolve into a single visual plane. It is a dwelling constituted by the jailer's impotence and by the speaker's free and sacred fertilization of a black womb, a dwelling from whose vantage the speaker can watch the world explode. At the time of Soleil Coucoupé's publication, 1948, Martinique was a semi-colonial society having recently become an overseas department of France. Césaire was the leading figure of a cohort of black artists and intellectuals who forthrightly rejected the French colonial order as part of the explicit program of Negritude, a neo-Africanist movement begun by middle-class Francophone students in Paris, which subsequently bloomed in French colonial territories on both sides of the Atlantic. Broadly, the artist of Negritude attacked the normative whiteness of French colonialism and sought to recuperate creatively an African selfhood. When seen against this backdrop, the poem's final semi-intentional utterance suggests an anti-colonial allegory. The jailer is the white colonizer, made impotent by the negritudist impregnation of the gendered African ideal, an act that explodes colonial reality. Césaire's poetic objective chance, as it were, summon an objective Africanness which pierces through the mediations of colonial history and the racialized subjectivity of the Negro, or Neg. Such an allegorical reading is compelling, but sits in tension with the poem's ascetic mode, which throws up the possibility of correspondence only abruptly to withdraw from it. If one chooses an allegory of negritude over its surrealist counter-epistemology, it turns the poem into the kind of orderly statement it is so obviously working to dissolve. On the other hand, to characterize this as an intention only to meaningless is just as misguided. Césaire's poetics are centered on the utterance as a gesture, and perhaps the key to its aesthetic will become apparent if we look at the way that this poem performs the making of dwelling, the way in which it performs the making of dwelling. Here the colonial situation is again, maybe it's better to go back to the page here. Again, the blah, blah, blah. The colonial situation is unavoidable, but in a different way. So by all definitions, and I'm getting toward the end now, all colonizing acts destroy dwelling. In its imperialist phase of the later 19th and early 20th century, when it was driven by what the Austrian economist Joseph Schumpeter characterized as a, quote, objectless disposition to forcible expansion, European colonial powers were intent on destroying the possibility of any dwelling beyond the perimeter of their empires altogether. As a late colonial subject, Césaire was writing in the wake of a process whose internal logic sought to destroy not just this or that colonized people's dwelling, but the possibility of non-colonial dwelling as such. It comes as no surprise, therefore, that to make a dwelling should be diverted from the spatial towards memory, eroticism, animism, dreaming, magic, perversion, and above all, confrontation. The jailer is, after all, the figure who imprisons space. In this respect, Césaire's poetics present the apogee of literary primitivism, an aesthetic mode whose history I can only point to here with a footnote to my book. Briefly, primitivism was an artistic response to the extinguishment of the space of the primitive, which is to say the space of the non-colonial. Primitivist works attempted to reanimate the possibility of primitive experience, an aspiration fraught, of course, with contradictions, very risky racialized contradiction, no doubt, but which was galvanized across the colonial world system as the welding of capital reached the point of geographical saturation. Primitivism was an aesthetic counterspell to the disappearance of the possibility of the primitive and the ideal of human life reconciled with nature. Césaire's achievement was to make these contradictions a principle of aesthetic form. I situate his work at the heart of this broader phenomenon of primitivism, not for the sake of labels, but in order to argue for it as an exemplary manifestation of world literature as a negative article of faith, a poetics that aims to instantiate the primitive in a world that has banished it. This is a quintessential localism where the local becomes the project of making a dwelling. Why should we want to call this poetics of dwelling an expression of world literature? And now I really am coming to the end. Certainly not because it enlists surrealistic poetic strategies that circulated transnationally at the time. The answer comes in cryptic form in another of Césaire's dwelling poems, this one titled Antipodal Dwelling. And this one's on your handout, the section that I focus on. Dwelling made of water glimpsed upon waking, dwelling made of rumpled perfumes, dwelling made of spangled sleep, dwelling made of swelled chest stretched out of benumbed lizards, strength lines me up on the shadowless meridian, python crews of catastrophes, denatured brothers of my longitude. Here again, anaphoric manic association prepares the ground for the intervention of an intentional act. The incantation of a dwelling gives the speaker the strength to stand on the shadowless meridian, where he comes into longitudinal alignment with his, quote, denatured brothers. Recall Solan's meridian, the shape of a circle which, via both poles, rejoins itself on the way serenely crosses even the tropics. I think I've missed something there. To make an antipodal dwelling is to find a longitude of those also cast from dwelling in nature. The light is that cast by the utopian possibility of once again finding a dwelling in nature. It is an epic choric meridian of world literature.